Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Support for this podcast comes from Smartwater. Want to get a little more from every sip? Smartwater Alkaline doesn't just taste crisp and pure. It's loaded with everything you need to perform at your best, whether you're running marathons or boardroom meetings. Elevate how you hydrate and pick up a Smartwater Alkaline today. To learn more, visit drinksmartwater.com.
Hey, it's Max. Before we get started, I want to tell you quickly about a sponsor that is making today's show possible. That sponsor is Squarespace. Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website. You can showcase your work, blog, or publish content, even sell products and services of all kinds. In just a few clicks, you can customize everything from look and feel to settings and products using beautiful templates created by world-class designers, and there's nothing to install, patch, or upgrade ever. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code LONGFORM to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thanks, Squarespace. Here's the show.
Hello. Welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer, Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hi. Hello.
We're doing some live shows.
Live shows.
Aaron, we're doing live shows.
Aaron.
Hey, I'm sorry. Shows. I was on my phone.
We're doing these live shows, man. We're doing one.
I can't come. I'm having a baby.
The great thing about live shows is you go in there, you cut off your phone, and you just focus on being present in the moment. That's what I love about a live show.
I hope
show.
You guys have a good time. Sounds really fun. Maybe I'll do one sometime. But in the meantime, how can people find out about this?
There's going to be two. One is in Chicago on Sunday, November 12th at 3 p.m. A place called The Hideout. I'm going to be interviewing Zoe Chase from This American Life. And then, Evan, you're doing one too.
Number two is November 15th in San Francisco, the Swedish American Hall. I'll be interviewing Kara Swisher. It's a co-production with Pop-Up Magazine and California Sunday Magazine. We're going to have a party afterwards. It's going to be very fun.
I'm going to say this. We want these shows to be incredible so we can go on a national tour, buses, the whole deal. So if you got a friend in San Francisco or Chicago who'd be into this kind of thing, let them know. It's on the long form Twitter. It'll be on the site. There's going to be all sorts of information about it. But we want to go crazy. We want to sell these out. We want these to be the biggest show in town.
Aaron is trying to travel the country with his small baby.
what show is this? Where are we?
This is the Long Form Podcast.
Who's on the show?
This week on the show, Jim Nelson, editor-in-chief of GQ Magazine.
You've been working on this for a long time.
I was very excited to talk to Jim Nelson, and I will tell you guys this. He did not disappoint.
Long time editor of GQ Magazine.
Yeah. He is coming up on his 15th year, which is also... GQ is celebrating its 60th birthday this year, so he's like right at a quarter of the whole magazine's run. I will say, I feel like we don't often like talk too much about what happened in the interview, but he was legitimately inspiring. He made me feel. I feel like we've had some low talks about magazines on the show in the last couple of months. Jim Nelson's bullish. And it affected me. I walked out feeling great.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like Jim Nelson doesn't actually talk in public that much.
No question, this is the longest interview he's ever done. And at the end of it, he was like, holy shit, how long was that?
That's exciting.
If you've got something to say that's longer than anything you've ever said before, you can probably still fit in an email. I think you can pretty much send as long an email as you want. And there's no better place to send that extremely long email than with MailChimp. They're sponsoring the show. Thank you, MailChimp.
And now here's Max with Jim Nelson.
Hey, Jim Nelson.
Hi.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
I'm excited too. I've got all kinds of questions for you.
Good. I'm here to answer questions.
All right. Well, I feel like there are many places for us to start, but here's the thing that I have found true of a couple of editors of magazines that I've talked to, and you fall into this category. There is not like a lot about you on the internet.
Yeah?
Yeah. You don't have a large internet presence. So I guess that's one question. It's just like, what's up with that?
It is purposeful in order to keep me. Of course, I have to do a lot of things in terms of like making sure that GQ's social media and internet presence is vibrant, and that keeps me up at night. But I find this kind of crazy affliction that's affected all my friends, where they live through Twitter and they become consumed by it, and it massages all the things: ego, self-absorption, a sense of sometimes self-importance, and even an insularity, that are all the things I kind of want to pull myself away from in my daily life. So for instance, on weekends, all I want to do is read novels and old books and old magazines even. I love studying old magazines. Of course, I am also working on a lot of manuscripts, but it's the thing that I want most in my life is balance and time, and kind of in a funny way, I think it does help my job a lot more than being on Twitter does.
It sounds so healthy. Are you also like a person?
I'm also like sitting around drinking wine and, well, I mean, like, and cooking meals with my boyfriend.
Yeah,
so.
I was going to wonder, like, do you like not try like exciting but probably bad for you drugs when you were a young person?
Yes,
either?
Yes. But I also do, I mean, I travel a lot. I assure you that I am incredibly engaged with the world. I'm like a travel junkie. I almost every weekend, if I'm not, I have a weekend house that we spend on the Delaware River, and that keeps me sane. But if I'm not there, I'm traveling and happy to be just sort of checking out a new city, a new scene. Some of that goes back into the magazine, my work at the magazine, because a lot of what we do is, besides features, is covering what's going on in the world.
Mm-hmm. Part of that is also being in the position that you are at that magazine. You don't need to do that stuff on some level. And I want to talk to you about that perch, because I feel like that's a pretty interesting perch in 2017.
Right.
But because there is not a whole lot about you, I feel like we should demystify things for a second. Tell me about how you got your start in this business.
Yeah, magazines, they were my third career, actually. After college, I started out in the news business at CNN in the 80s. That was sort of in my blood. Many
times.
I know. No, the Iran-Contra scandal. I was field producing, staking out Oliver North's house.
Did you want to be on TV?
I didn't want to be on TV, no, but I loved writing. And I loved it in particular when I realized what TV news was. The part of it that I liked was that it was aural. You had to learn how to catch people's attention through the ear. And I don't think people realize that unless they actually write TV news, that, yeah, there's someone usually beautiful or handsome, you know, in front of the camera talking smoothly, and there's all kinds of visuals going on. But the only way you really hear this stuff or a story resonates with you is orally. And I kind of loved for a brief while, I loved doing that. My grandfather was a White House photographer, and his son, my uncle, who was sort of like a hero to me, was the first White House bureau chief for CNN, Washington bureau chief. And I thought I wanted to do it because I was excited by their life of travel and just a career that just seemed larger than life.
Mm-hmm.
But when I actually did it, it's much smaller than life. It is, by definition, smaller than life.
I mean, like, it's not at the top, right?
No, of course, not at the top. And that can be exciting. But what I also learned very quickly is that the sort of daily churn, and it's kind of even connected to this Twitter conversation we talked about, the daily churn of doing news keeps you from getting to more meaningful, deeper truths.
Mm-hmm.
And you just are reactive. You're just spending all your time reacting. And I remember, this is a terrible thing to admit to, but when the Challenger happened, this is so terrible, but my friend called me and said, the Challenger, and you know, exploded. And my first thought was, oh shit, I'm gonna spend the next weeks and weeks in this flurry of reaction, and there was going to be something obscene about it. I just remember it unsettled me, thinking that, oh, I know what's going to happen. This is going to explode their ratings. I just went to work with a sense of doom.
Mm-hmm. It was like you were just
horror too.
You were just seeing the world through like 24/7 TV goggles.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I also, people who worked in TV news get incredibly frazzled and burnt out really quickly, as do people who work in social media too much. And I just always kind of wanted to have, I wanted to tell bigger stories. I got frustrated. I remember one day saying that most of my job was writing either what we call 25-second tells. A tell is something that's just straight news story without voiceover video. And I would be like, I'd have to tell a story about Algeria in 25 seconds. And half of that is spent saying, you know this country that's called Algeria? You know where that is and how it was affected by this and that? And then you spend 12 of those 25 seconds sort of just catching the listener or the viewer up, and then the rest of it telling the story. And it just depressed me after a while. And the other thing was that for a while I thought I wanted to live in LA and I wanted to work in Hollywood and I wanted to make movies. I had that, I was just the walking cliche of the kid who at 25 quits their job. I think I worked for 4 years at CNN and I just packed all my bags and went to LA.
A place where everyone goes to find meaning.
Yes, exactly. And it's the last place you should probably go looking for meaning. And my very first job in LA was working on the 100th episode of Who's the Boss, serving fake champagne and cake, anniversary cake, to the audience. I took whatever job I could get, and that helped me get a job, an interview as a writer's assistant. And I ended up getting hired to be a writer's assistant for a couple of assistants. I wrote about this for GQ once, called The Horrible Bosses of Hollywood. And, you know, I wrote spec scripts, and I thought I wanted to. That was between like 25 to 30, pretty much.
Yeah.
And I worked with some great people. I worked on a couple of Norman Lear shows. I worked with people that I got to admire on a couple of. Most of the time when you work in Hollywood, to be clear, you work on like pilots and six episodes and shows that last 11 episodes max. And, you know, you can work for years and years and years and never get on a hit series.
How did you know when it was time to pack it up?
I think there was this thing called magazines that was calling me, and honestly, it's the funniest thing because I was a Harper's Magazine fanatic, and also the New Yorker and some other magazines, Atlantic back then. I would just read them cover to cover, and I would like cut out the articles. I would Xerox them and send them to friends, give them around to the reporters at CNN. I was probably just an obnoxious pill. But I just thought these stories were incredible and affecting, and I wanted to share them. And when I went out to LA, I was maybe I retreated even more to the world of magazines. I would, because LA was not, especially then in early 90s, is not like, you couldn't find a lot of people who cared about Harper's Magazine. But as it happened, a friend of
now,
mine...
Now if you go to LA, it's just...
Now it's just full of Harper's junkies.
That's the whole place.
A friend of mine knew these two guys, Jack Hitt and Paul Tough, and she worked with Fred Friendly, who was a radio producer, actually. And Paul and Jack would come out to LA, and she's like, I know you're like a Harper's freak. You should come out to drinks with us one time. So I did, and I was probably, again, so overwhelmingly nerdy about it. I just asked them so many questions, and at one point, Paul was like, whoa, you know, maybe you should be a stringer for us. And my first job in magazines, while I still was in LA, I would make $150 a month to send to the Harper's Reading section. I was sort of like the LAI, things that I thought I had read, and I started to learn how to do it too, how to find odd documents, and sometimes it was the artwork that was in LA galleries, but a lot of times I would try to snoop around and call a friend and get a Hollywood studio executive's memo or something like that. And I started getting things in the magazine right away, and I can't tell you what a thrill that was.
Did it feel different than these other spaces you had been in? Like, did it feel different than CNN, and did it feel different than being in these writers' rooms in Hollywood?
It felt a lot different. It felt, for one, I felt like I was the, even if it was just one little piece, I felt like I was the architect of my own destiny, that I was finding this stuff. It was my eye. And that mattered a lot to me. I mean, there are parts of working in Hollywood where you're working on something creative and it actually does mirror the magazine experience in some ways because you're working on a team effort. But just getting in something that I also just thought was so meaningful, I thought this magazine just, you know, rocked. And so to see it, and then Paul came back and Jack came back on another trip, and they said to me, I was like, how can I get more involved? And they're like, well, you could apply for the internship you know, the fact that you've been a stringer might help you, but you're going to have to start from the very bottom. And I applied for the internship. I was 30. I got it. I moved from LA to New York to make no money. I had saved like a couple thousand bucks from working on sitcoms. And I just started doing this internship. And as soon as I did it, it's just this community of thinkers and talkers and writers. David Foster Wallace would come by the office and work on, you know, the cruise ship piece and State Fair piece. And it just blew my mind that I could be a part of something like this. And of course, I was mostly just fact-checking Harper's Index and trying to figure out what the ratio of per capita spending was, you know, for some factoid. But then after that, you do that internship for 4 or 5 months, you get to do the kind of work that you always dreamed of.
What and was it like to be the 30-year-old intern?
It was a little bit of an adjustment for me. Part of it was just that I knew that it was, for me, it was the right move and it felt right that way, but I also felt like I had a little bit more to lose. You know, if it wasn't this, then I was just going to wash up. I didn't know what I was going to do. And then afterwards, I didn't have, at Harper's, a job opens up glacially. I mean, there's just not that many positions opening. So I kind of freelanced for 6 months and then a job opened up at the reading section and Paul thought of me and I got it and I started working at the reading section and eventually ran that with a woman named Alexandra Ringe and thus began another 4 happy years until I decided to move on.
And I'm interested in that time in Harper's, although I feel like we've had a lot of people on the show from that kind of like, it's like mid-90s era of Harper's.
Yeah. I was there 93 to 97.
Tell me about making the leap from Harper's to GQ.
It was scary because Harper's was unlike any other place. When I finished the internship, I would go to places like New York Review of Books. Lewis Lapham would set you up with an interview with Bob Silvers or something. And it was just like, you'd walk in there and you'd just see piles of books and you'd think that they were going to topple over and kill everyone. And it was just like a different universe. It wasn't a glossy magazine. But a friend of mine, Elena Silverman, who is now at the New York Times Magazine, she had gone to Vogue from Harper's, spent a year there as features editor, and then went to GQ. And she told me, she's like, do you ever read GQ? And I was like, nah. She's like, you should really read it. It's actually got this great feature writing. And I just started reading it, and I kind of couldn't believe it. And that was the time when they were running like Tom Junod, and you know, David Granger was editor there, Elena, and they were running just great, great stuff. And I got drawn into that. And it was the first time I thought, I guess I really could imagine leaving Harper's and working on a glossy and making more than $23,000 a year. It would be incredible. And so then a job opened up and I interviewed with Art Cooper, and that was like interviewing in the era of Mad Men. I mean, it was just like open up a bottle of bourbon, you know, just during your interview. You know, Art Cooper was this legendary editor. He was the editor for 20 years of GQ. And that truly was, I'm happy that I got to see that, because the first 6 years, I've been at Harper, I mean, at GQ since 1997, which is crazy. I've been editor since 2003. And I'm so glad I got to see those first 6 years. It was sort of, to be honest, it was the tail end of Art Cooper's career. And it wasn't maybe his golden years, because Granger had left and he was feeling assailed by Esquire on the one side, and on the other side there was, you know, these laddie magazines, Maxim, then there was Men's Health, Men's Journal. These were health juggernauts, and GQ was trying to, I guess, hold up a flag for what seemed to me like Rat Pack era gentlemanliness, and then also some great long form. But it just felt like it needed, I felt like for those 6 years that I was living in a different era, mm-hmm. that I'd gone from one kind of strange magazine culture, Harper's, to another GQ.
Did people think you were selling out?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Some of my, I mean, they all understood because they're all making $18,000, $23,000. They're like, okay, see you later. Tell me what it's like over there. But also, you know, Harper's is a great place, but it's, as I'm sure some of these people talk about it, it is, it's a kind of monoculture. And just the curiosity of seeing what the world was like outside of there got the better part of me. And So I witnessed a different era of GQ for 6 years, and I got to witness also what it's like to run a magazine, to see somebody else do it, so that when I actually got the chance, I knew how complicated it was.
Hey, I'm going to put Jim on hold for just a second to tell you a little bit about our sponsor today. The show is supported by Squarespace. Are you ready to start your new business? Make it stand out with Squarespace. They've got beautiful templates created by world-class designers, and Squarespace makes it so easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website. Just over a year ago, I started a company, a podcasting company. It's called Pineapple Street Media, and the first thing we did was build a website, because you need a website. You just, you got to do it. Here is a fun fact. Built it with Squarespace. I waited till like the last minute, really needed to build something, and it was so easy. It took like 2 seconds. It looks great. We are still using Squarespace to this day. Nothing has ever broken. It always just works. That's how Squarespace works. It's super easy. A couple other things you should know about Squarespace. One, everything's optimized for mobile right out of the box. It just works on people's phones. You can use Squarespace's analytics to help you grow your audience in real time. And best of all, there's nothing to patch, install, or upgrade ever. If you do hit a snag, again, we have never hit one, but if you do, Squarespace has award-winning 24/7 customer support right there to help. The future is coming. Make it brighter with Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code LONGFORM to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Again, that's squarespace.com, offer code LONGFORM. Thanks very much to them for sponsoring the show, and let's get back to Jim Nelson. Can you tell me about getting that job? I mean, there must have been a lot of people who were up for that job.
There were. And I think the reason that I got it in some part was because I didn't know if I wanted it. In that, at that point, I had started writing a lot more. I was always wanted to do, you know, I thought I wanted to be a long-form feature writer. And I had done several pieces for Art Cooper while I was still trying to edit. I can't do like the David Remnick thing, and I'm so in awe of what he does, like those long pieces while running a weekly. I don't know how a guy like that does it. But I was trying at that point to just steer my career more into a writing path. And I talked Art Cooper into letting me work with just 3 or 4 writers. It was like Chuck Bowden, Liz Gilbert, Andrew Corsello, a few others. And I would just write 3 to 5 features a year. I did a piece on AIDS deniers, this crazy, wacky ACT UP group in San Francisco. I did a piece on the House of Lords, which I loved writing, about how they were trying to get rid of their peers. And it was kind of it helped me, though, figure out how to be in that voice and how to be kind of funny, but also serious, and to how to toggle between those voices. So I was really grateful for that. And then when Art Cooper announced he was leaving, Art threw my hat in the ring along with someone else. And then a bunch of people put their hats in the ring. And I thought, I was just reading, you know, in the New York Post, they love to speculate about that stuff. And I was like, there's just no way I'm gonna get this job. But I wrote a memo and I interviewed with James Truman, who was the editorial director then, and interviewed with Cy Newhouse. And I just kind of was like, I think part of it was because I wasn't sure that I wanted it. And I kept saying, this is what I think you should do with GQ. I think you should modernize the fashion. You should make it more serviceable, relatable, demystify some of that stuff. And then the thing that's not wrong with GQ is features and report. And I want to do more of that. I just want to make it livelier and bring in new voices. And I said, if you want to get rid of that, you should not hire me. And I was just very clear, because I also didn't want a job that I wouldn't want, you know? I didn't want to be responsible for a publication that I would have to take out all the interesting parts. And I worried that might be what they wanted. And it's interesting, I wrote this long memo, and when Cy Newhouse died, I mentioned this in a piece I wrote about him.
Yeah, but I read it.
Yeah, it was just like, he was amazing. He asked a zillion questions about what I wanted to do, and I think James Truman had already decided that he wanted me. And then he had that great quote where he said, look, a magazine is a mix of constancy and surprise. You have to have enough constancy, columnists, voices, design, things that make people feel like they know that terrain, and then just surprise them all the time. And that was actually incredibly liberating to hear that, because it's exactly what I wanted to do.
And is that when, I mean, it sounds like you were kind of ambivalent about whether or not you wanted the job.
Yeah, I was ambivalent if I thought that they were going to want to take it into something that I didn't want to take it. I also thought, well, there goes my writing career.
Yeah.
And I really was. I mean, for the first 2 years of that job, I felt like I was sinking. It was thrilling. I just was trying to reinvent it, and I was, every issue just felt like I didn't have any rhythm yet. I didn't know how to do this. And
what do you do when you're in a job and you don't know how to do it and there's no one above you? I mean, how do you deal with that?
Well, you remember something that actually Art Cooper said to me years ago, which is like, in the end, remember it's $4.99 and $4.99 an issue, and another one comes next month. And that was actually kind of liberating, because like, it let me say I can screw up and I can start all over again next month.
Did you screw up in those first couple of years?
When I look back at those issues, I think that they were good. They were just trying to be something else. I had to figure out what my GQ was going to be and what I wanted it to be. And it was a little all over the place. Part of it was trying to identify this thing that I eventually freed myself of, which was thinking so much about who this reader is. In fact, the reader of GQ is incredibly varied, right? There's people that read it, they come up to me sometimes, they said, like, I've been reading it since I was in grade school and I'm 58 now. And I just, you know, and that makes me so happy when I hear that some people come up to me sometimes and they say, you know, I basically use it as a manual for style growing up, all this stuff. That makes me incredibly happy. But I also know that some people read it for great feature writing and reporting. And I, as I got more confident, I realized that I could create something that was just what I wanted to read, as simple as that.
Had you ever been a boss before?
Never, never been a boss. That was another thing that was tough, just realizing that everyone's waiting on you for all the answers and all the direction and all the, it's quite natural if you just have to remember that that's what you did to your old boss. But the pressure was also, in the beginning too, there was a lot of, I would lose a day in agitation over some page six thing about how Jim Nelson is talking behind closed doors. His door is always closed, you know, and things like that. And I'd be like, God, Jim Nelson spent money on a car to Palm Springs. And I would just be like, what? Who is telling these stories? And then you get vaguely paranoid. And then you just, at a certain point, you just don't care anymore. You realize that the gossip columns and the page six stuff and all that, it is this fictitious world that you can choose to either tune in or tune out of, and it doesn't really matter. Because one day I remember I missed something that was horrible about me, and I just didn't, I hadn't read page six that day, and then someone later on said to me, oh, did you read that thing? It was really terrible. And I was like, yeah, I realized it hadn't affected my mood because I hadn't read it. So that helps too.
Yeah. Help me understand that thing just a little bit better. Like, you at that age, right, you spent like what, 6 years at Harper's?
Yeah, 4 years at
four
Harper's.
Years at Harper's, six years in that job. So it's like 10 years before,
yeah,
you're like sitting in LA, yeah, looking for obscure documents while handing out fake champagne to TV audiences.
It was quite the life.
And 10 years later, you're running this place and people are writing fucking articles in the paper about whether or not your door is open.
Yeah. I also think that people think the culture of Condé Nast is all nasty and, you know, hushed town cars and all this kind of stuff. And one thing I got to know pretty soon was that, like, Cy Newhouse was completely amused by that stuff, by the gossip stuff, but he didn't care. He always stuck by his editors. He took the long view, and that just helped me too. There were a couple of also, like, fights I had to have along the way that gave me a little bit more confidence that I didn't have to worry about all these things. I remember one of the first issues I did, I had this story about, it had a gay theme in it. And I put it was Rick Santorum's Big Gay Adventure was the cover line. And it was when he had said the stuff about bestiality and all the stuff, if you recall. This is like 2003 or four. And it was just absurd. So Robert Draper, the writer, ended up profiling him. And we put that cover line on. And I had to present the magazine every month to Cy Newhouse and all the executives. And when I presented it to them...
Before or after it's like going to press?
Before, just before. It was called, we used to call it print order, which meant that you would present the book before you could order it, before you could actually send it to the printers. Because if Cy didn't like something or, you know, somebody had a problem with it, you might have to pull something.
That sounds real intense.
It was super intense. That was the most, I mean, my job has changed in many, many ways, but one of the ways it's changed most appreciably is in that sort of deadline pressure, that because now it's like there's a zillion deadlines every day, and it's not as just, you know, print centrically anxious making that way. But every month, that man, that was the biggest day. Then I'd show it to Cy and the executives, and I remember being a little bit like, I was trying to change the magazine, trying to modernize it. We put Johnny Knoxville on the cover of the first issue I did, and we didn't know how, if they were liking it, if the readers were going to like it. But I remember having that cover, and it said Rick Santorum's Big Gay Adventure. And one of the executives, who I will not name but who has passed on, stopped me right there. And he had once been publisher of GQ, so he knew. And he's like, look, this magazine cannot be seen as a gay magazine. And I knew what he was saying. Like, this is a piece of advocacy journalism, you fag. And I remember I got so angry. I just defended myself in front of all of them. I was just like, if you're trying to accuse me of advocacy journalism and you don't have enough foresight to see that this is a news story, a legitimate story, this isn't a gay story, it's a story that everyone should care about, and I'd invite you to read it before you have an opinion. And then Cy looked over and laughed, and then we moved on. And that always meant so much, that laugh. It was like, I guess Point Nelson, I guess. I don't know. I guess I can publish the story and I don't have to change the gay cover line.
Well, it's all in the laugh.
Yeah.
What has been hard about the job?
I think what's hard about the job is constantly trying to find new revenue streams, new platforms, then you discover and you go and you enter in those platforms and you think you're doing a great job, and then you realize those platforms are dead ends. I'll just give you one example. Several years ago, the iPad was supposed to save publishing, if you remember this.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and our company went full bore into it, and you know, I could see why they thought it might, and there were so many upsides. You know, it was almost like the year of magical thinking, because it was like, yeah, we won't have to kill trees. And you'll even get more money from the consumer because, you know, they're going to spend all their money on a subscription and it's going to be free, no paper. And we put so much time and effort into this beautiful iPad edition of GQ, which we still do, but we thought it was going to save publishing. And what it meant was that we were now doing yet another edition of GQ with designed and everything. I mean, the design is also a huge part of it for us. Our design director, Fred Woodward, is just kind of, we call him the Freditor. And he just put his heart and soul into this iPad edition, and it didn't. It ended up being an enormous time suck. There are other things, there are new platforms all the time that I think we should be in. Like, I think we should be in Snapchat. We are. I actually like our Snapchat Discover thing. I love it. Now, what the ratio of profits that makes versus the old traditional ridiculously lucrative print glossy format is, it's just a completely different model. And you know, that's been the struggle. It's the same struggle everywhere in publishing nowadays, of trying to figure out how do you keep doing what you do and do well, you think, and make it rich and engaging in other platforms and still make money. It's why we're doing podcasts, I think.
We could talk about podcasting if you want. I remember like 2011. I remember that like iPad app.
Do you?
Craze. Yeah. It was so optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in hindsight, it was naively optimistic. Like, yeah. Well, this was going to solve everything. And yeah. Then we're done with this. And I wonder whether you feel more cynical about those things now.
I wouldn't say it's cynical, but I do feel like I've been through enough of these waves now where I feel like, okay, I can smell when something's being sold to me. And I also, sometimes you just don't know though. You just don't know. Like, Instagram has actually surprised me because it's been, you think, some people think, oh, that's mostly just images. But we have, they're actually a great partner for sort of feeding stories, and we get traffic by linking in bio stuff. But like, we have an incredibly engaged Instagram reader, and we do different things with them, and that's become like this profitable source for us. And I think that, like, when I look ahead, I think, yeah, Instagram, that's going to be a big part of GQ's future for a long time. Video is another thing. Like, again, it's not like you get cynical. You just get, you like, what you hope is that the promises keep up with your abilities to produce at the pace that you can. And I think the thing that is also challenging nowadays is figuring out, in a fractured digital universe, how do you keep that GQ personality that you spent so much time unifying under one print roof, right? In the print version of GQ, you've got all these different personalities, voices, and the thing that keeps it together beyond the adhesive is this sensibility, right? And this idea that this goes with that, and the pace and the mix and all these things that I love putting together.
Like, there's also like a inherent quality level.
Yes.
Like, the magazine is at a certain bar. There's things that are on different axes of quality, but the magazine is at this certain bar. And I imagine that a challenge has to be trying to extend that bar when you're going to be on 15 new platforms and have all these daily deadlines and be doing all this like new work, essentially.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And I think we're slowly getting there. It's like, one of the things that has become, that was initially a challenge, was we would all think of like the print side and the digital side. And now what we all think about is, okay, we're just, stop saying GQ.com and GQ the print edition. It's just GQ. and just, once you cross that line, you don't ever want to go back to it. I just can't imagine. The job has changed so much even in the last 3 years that when I look back, I think, God, I was just such a quaint little fucker.
Is it fun? Is it fun doing all this new stuff?
It is fun. What's fun is that puzzle that I'm telling you. It's also the hard part, which is like, yeah, how do I figure out how you keep creating new platforms that keep that voice and make sure that you're still doing the long form, long view assignments and don't just get into this reactive thing. Because look, here's the simple reality. I could meet all our website traffic goals just by giving hot takes on Donald Trump. I don't want to do that. That makes me feel bad. I won't feel great unless I marry that with, that is our next great experiment. It's not just long form feature writing for the print edition that then gets translated onto the website and does great. But how can we do that on a digital model as well? And you just have to be savvier. You have to like negotiate your contracts differently. We've already changed the way we pay writers. We talk more about like project fees than we do word rates. And I think that's actually smart because word rates just will drive everyone crazy. But that is a cultural shift that's happened really only in the last few years.
I've had a bunch of people on the show recently who I think I could safely describe as like a little freaked out about the state of magazines. I don't know whether it's coincidence or not, but like the last couple of months have been particularly rough. Like Graydon Carter, editor of Time, Glamour, Rolling Stone selling. Like,
yeah,
there's all these people in your universe and particularly in your perch in that universe who are leaving. And you don't sound freaked out to me at all.
I'm not freaked out, only because I just always think it's in the people and in the personalities you keep. For instance, last year, you know, we went through another round of budget cuts, and I was just like, I was just bummed for a couple months, and nothing weighs on you more heavily than those kinds of things. And I remember getting past it and trying to figure out how we were going to readjust the way we used our writers, readjust the way we balanced between digital and print. And when I sat after that process, it was, I remember having dinner with Chris Heath, the writer, and I just said, you know what, I got through the end of that. And I know there will be another round of waves, but what I'm doing constantly is just kind of managing change, which is what I've been doing since I got the job. And I have faith that I can figure out the next thing. And I said to Chris, I remember we were having dinner, and I was like, and I just, after the end of this, I just feel an enormous amount of gratitude that I get to work with people like you and get to work on great, great stories. I'll never regret it if I can do that.
I assume like budget cuts are a euphemism for having to lay people off.
Yeah. Not only. I mean, sometimes budget cuts mean you have less money to spend on stories or less money to spend on videos.
Do you get better at having those kinds of conversations after being in this job for 15 years almost?
I don't know if you ever get better at it. I think the best, it's the only way, is to just be honest and try to be humane about it, and then try to find a way to help them and keep the relationship going. Even people that I had to let go over the years and people that don't work with us full time still have connections to the magazine. And I really do think this may be me sounding naive, but I really do believe in this sense of community, and even like I always say the GQ family, and maybe that sounds cheeseball, but like I actually believe in it, and it actually does come from my very first connection to magazines. And I told this to Lewis Lapham once. I said, "No, you're not a sentimental person, but the reason why I was drawn to Harper's in the first place was because it felt to me like a community of readers, and that it made me feel smarter, and that I knew that other people were reading the same thing." And I still feel like that. I feel like I have this obligation to a community of readers. And even as that community changes constantly, I just got to do right by them and do great work.
I'm going to ask you one more question about doing your job, and then we're going to talk about writing.
Yeah.
Imagine, like, for whatever reason, something happened, you had to step down. How would you convince the person that you thought was best for that job to take your place? How would you convince them to do that?
To take my place at GQ?
Yeah. Like, just say something happens in the cosmos. You can't do that anymore.
Right. It wouldn't be difficult at all. I would just be like, this job is awesome. Sometimes it's stressful. You get to run great stories. You get to work with great people. Why wouldn't you take the job?
I guess my implication is like maybe that person is reluctant about taking up the head of a glossy magazine in 2017.
Right. Well, the first thing I would say is that, like, you are a fool if you think you're becoming just the editor of a glossy magazine. And, you know, you're becoming the editor of all those things. And hopefully this person cares about all that stuff, cares about feature writing, but also cares about video and what they can do in all kinds of platforms. And they're not thinking, I think people have this perception that the world of glossy magazines was just this, like we all sat around like in the days of Art Cooper drinking whiskey and taking town cars. The culture has changed so much over the years. Again, the ones that thrive are the ones that feel that, like, I'm just going to maximize what I can do, feel fortunate for what I can do, and recognize that whatever job I think I'm getting is not really the job I'm getting. It's the job that's going to be in 3 years, in 5 years, and you can't sell somebody on the job that is. It's the job that it's going to be.
All right, let's talk about writing.
Yeah.
You've been in this job for 15 years, almost, coming up?
Coming up, yep.
God, I'm old.
I'm just going to keep saying that over and over again. What are the stories that have stuck with you? You've overseen hundreds and hundreds of incredible feature stories. So which are the ones that stick with you?
I mean, so many, but they're the ones that have a ton of voice and a ton of heart and have some kind of unique perch, some unique point of view on that whole world. So, I mean, when you said that, my mind went to John Jeremiah Sullivan's Christian rock piece, Upon This Rock. That was a piece where even just in the editing stage, we were just like, we were just gleeful. We just knew that it was just something really special and weird and fucking cool. And that it also had heart to it. And there, I mean, there's this part in it, I'm going to name some other pieces, but there's this part in it where John, I mean, I grew up in Catholics. I went to Catholic, actually 12 years, 16 years, even Catholic university. And so I grew up in this culture a little bit. And there's this line where John Sullivan says, Jesus, man, I like that guy. You know, it's just it's this thing about how he really dug Jesus and how Jesus, there was a time when he was in love with Jesus. And it's actually this very funny, I mean, it's very, only John Sullivan could write this as deftly as he does, but this reckoning that he had when, what he was doing with that piece was reckoning with his faith, his previous faith, and other people who had a faith he no longer did. And of course, he did it with just like literary pyrotechnics and in inimitable style and completely memorable opening scene.
Yeah, one of the greats.
Yeah, yeah. Leeds. I spend a lot of time on Leeds, and I can come back to that. But when you, but also pieces like George Saunders' Buddha Boy, which was about this mystical kid that had been in a state of kind of hyper meditation, almost like frozen, and people were visiting from all over, and he basically became like a holy entity. And George just went over there to find out what this was. That was the assignment. And we were like, George, would you do this? But that piece, I think, you know, there's so many pieces by Jean Marie Laskus that sit with me. That whole series of Hidden America that she did with air traffic controllers, coal miners. I remember when my mom wanted to talk to me about the coal miners piece. She's like, I never thought I'd care about coal miners. But she hooked me from the first sentence. I was like, ah, I got mom, yes. But those pieces, her piece on Joe Biden, her piece, The Bureau of Way Too Many Guns, and stories like Wells Tower's piece on Burning Man, when he took his dad to Burning Man. I love the Dear Leader Dreams of Sushi, the piece by Adam Johnson. I love Sean Flynn's piece, which is just becoming a movie. It was called No Exit, and now it's becoming Only the Brave. And so those, Chris Heath's Zanesville Zoo piece is another, like, that's just a masterful, masterful piece. Taffy Ackner's piece on Sugar Daddies. Those are just a few that come to my mind. That Mike Paterny's Suicide Catcher. I love reading these pieces. I read them again and again and again. I love reading them. There's this moment where I will, you know, I love running to a lunch or dinner by myself, sitting in a bar and just reading the piece. I read it at every stage, first proof, second proof, third proof, but also even later once it's published. There's these stories that I have a relationship with that I love reading over and over again. They're almost like my Grimm's fairy tales.
Well, there's something, I mean, there's a bunch of things that you just said that I want to ask more about, but one thing that's so striking about that group of stories is like, there's this kind of GQ story that I've been reading for years, years and years. That's the kind of like crazy entertaining, hilarious adventure, insane story. Like almost can't believe it story, you know? Like in a way, I almost think of those as GQ stories.
Mm.
We used to have this, I guess we still do, have this category at the end of the year. We do this best of the year list. And we had a category that was like wildly entertaining.
Yeah.
Just most wildly entertaining stories. And like there was always like three GQ stories on most wildly entertaining.
That makes me so happy to hear that.
But the stories that you just talked about are different.
Yeah.
They're all pretty quiet stories. And they're like emotional stories.
Yeah.
And they're almost all stories in which the writer opens themselves up quite a bit.
That's true.
That's just striking to me that those are the ones of all of these like hundreds, that those are the ones that you pick out.
Yeah. I mean, they don't strike me as quiet, which is interesting. But I will say that they'd strike me as emotional. And I think that if there was one thing that draws me to a story and that I'm also always trying to pull out of a story, is the human emotional connection. Because if you read the Zanesville Zoo story, has these, it's got lions and tigers and bears, literally. But the portrait that emerges out of it is a very human, a complex, troubling human story of a guy that, you know, there's that last scene in the piece where you find out that he had a monkey that he felt protected him during the Vietnam War. And, you know, there's all these other things in that piece. And there's also a line in the piece that says, Terry Thompson was the guy's name, if you remember, in Zane's with the guy that was a zookeeper that let all those animals out and then killed himself. And Chris won the, you know, a National Magazine Award for reporting for that because it was incredibly exhaustively reporting. But the line in that piece that sticks with me is that Terry Thompson's story was told round the world, but also it was rarely told. And that line says so much to me because what it means is that a lot of times what happens to the stories that are really compelling to me are you're looking through, our news media simply doesn't have the time, temperament, or metabolism to really look into. And that I'm always looking to see if there's a story where if you just pause the tape a little bit and you went to look at that story that people already think that they digested or they already think that they heard, could you, like Chris Heath's Uber Killer piece, could you go back and see what made that guy do that? And I think if there's anything that draws all these stories, Jean Marie's story on Joe Biden, you know, a guy that had been written about a zillion times, that to me, that's the best profile of Joe Biden that's ever been written. And that's because she has that empathetic ear. If you ever go out to eat with her, it's just like, as you have, I think, she is the best listener.
Of all time.
Of all time, yes. Yeah. And that act of listening is an ennobling act. It makes somebody feel that they're a little bit bigger than they might feel in their normal life, that someone actually wants to hear their story. We do, we're curious. And you also will always find, if you find the emotional factor in a story, that story has a far, far, far greater chance of being memorable, right? I think nowadays, we're so full of factoids and so full of streaming data that a story that hits us that makes us feel empathy or makes us feel like there is a real human aching soul at the other side of it just stops us. I mean, I'm thinking about this piece we just ran on the accidental assassins of North Korea. That writer just, I mean, it's a great piece of reporting, but what he did was essentially find the two women at the core of that story that were, they didn't know that they were being assassins. And he told they're both in jail. They couldn't talk to us. And he found a way to very empathetically reveal that they were just kind of in a funny way. I feel like it's a metaphor for all the stuff going on in the world right now where, you know, larger international forces kind of exploit the most innocent human. And you end up feeling nothing but empathy for them because they're sort of washed out of their, you know, of their local economy and they end up in some strange city and then suddenly the next thing they know, they think they're going to be stars and they're going to be in a reality show and they get completely fooled into assassinating the brother of the North Korean leader. To me, that was a feat of storytelling and a lot of it was just the human empathy that went in that reporting.
Finding that empathy, telling stories with that empathy, is that something that you can teach a writer or are you looking for people who have some natural ability to do that because it's not something that you can teach them how to do?
I think some writers are just truly obviously gifted and are more empathetic than others. I think sometimes you can push people's curiosities toward empathy. I mean, I think the writers we're talking about are all incredibly empathetic people. But if you're asking the question, you know, is it possible to teach that? I think it is in the sense that, you know, our notes are always about like, tell us more about this. Tell us more about, oh, that's interesting. It's funny because I just got this note from a writer that was telling me he did a little piece and it was like a essay about reducing his wardrobe. And in the piece, there was this line about how his father had gone through this death and suicide in his family. And it was just like this one little line. And I was like, okay, I need to hear more about that. And then we ended up expanding it. And now it's becoming a book for him. And part of it, he was just saying was, you know, thinking about my father and why did I want to write that piece was really about my father. And to me, that's what you're always trying to push people is sometimes there's these things that you're not really thinking about that have a deeper emotional connection and you don't want to push it to the point where it's like a button that doesn't push. But if there is something there that is a little deeper, by all means, explore it.
Part of your job, I mean, you have a bunch of people working for you doing this too, but part of your job is looking for new voices all the time to bring into this like GQ family that you've been talking about. What are you looking for in people? How do you make that choice? Where do people need to be as a writer for them to be ready for you?
Well, sometimes it's just a great idea. And I would also say that lots of people have great ideas. And then my next question is, how can I have confidence that you'll execute it and you'll bring something different? And that's a whole nother conversation. The thing that I am always trying to bring in new writers. And sometimes it's like, I'll look at fiction writers. I'll think, gosh, you can tell certain novelists have a nonfiction gift. If they went out into the world, their curiosity is so great. George Saunders is, you know, a natural reporter, even though he's the world's greatest novelist and short story writer. And I was thinking about Karen Russell, and she wrote this piece called about the One-Eyed Matador. And that piece was, that's a perfect lead to me, a perfect lead. Of course, it's, you know, talking about an eye getting poked out by a bull. Hard to screw that one up. But it was just like, Karen writes every single sentence. I love these writers. Our editor, Dan Riley, who just has this book, Fly Me, is like this too. Like, every sentence just sings. It's incredible. And it doesn't have this sense of feeling like it's been worked over. It probably has. But it doesn't have this sense of being polished until the life comes out of it. And Karen just blew me away just how a fiction writer could just so instantly transition into a journalist. That doesn't always work, but I'm also looking for writers that recognize that what they're doing is not just reporting a story, not just giving news of the world, but actually telling stories. That's a harder thing to do. It's just, I always think about, I always say that Liz Gilbert is the single most gifted storyteller I've ever worked with, because she would sit down there and say, I'm going to tell you a story about this. And she'd do it quite nakedly. I mean, I remember one of the first pieces I got to work on with her was this piece called Lucky Jim, which was about a guy that had, he was a paraplegic. He got back into shape. He, you know, was doing marathons. And then at a marathon, he was run over by a truck and he became a quadriplegic. And he then became an inspirational speaker. That story was just astonishing, the fact of it. And I also thought, okay, how are we gonna tell a story about the most depressing thing that you could ever possibly imagine happening to you? And I remember, this was actually when Art Cooper was editor, I remember taking Liz into Art's office and saying, there really isn't any reason you should assign the story to anyone else but Liz Gilbert, because Liz will find a way to make this piece about something else. She'll struggle to find that meaning in it. But I'm always looking for people that recognize the larger story that they might themselves think they're looking for, and trying to find something, even if it's a news story, or if it's a story that is in the news, like the North Korean assassins, what's the way to tell the story that is going to affect people? I always say, in the simplest sense, that I don't want to just publish stories that even get good reviews or that readers love. I want to publish stories that fucking slay people, that affect them, that they remember. I even think that's kind of the simplest standard, is like, it means so much to me that you say that you think of these stories as GQ stories, because that means that, one, you've remembered them and they have a kind of unique character. And if that's human emotion, if that is funny as shit, because sometimes that can be it too. I told you earlier I wanted to talk a little bit about leads too. And that's another thing. I can tell by a pitch whether somebody knows how to write a lead. Because in a way, a pitch, it's like a brief encapsulation of your gift of storytelling, right? And sometimes I can tell a writer gets too nervous and psychs himself out in a pitch, and then it's just like, wow, this pitch sounds like the cliff note version of a great story, but it doesn't give me any faith that this person can tell a great story. And sometimes the stories that I go for just have this, they might have missed all these other details, which we can get later on in the reporting, but if they figure out that this story about North Korean assassins is really about like this crazy story of two women who got brought into an international conspiracy, the international conspiracy, which is outrageous in and of itself, in an odd way becomes the less memorable thing about that piece. The most memorable thing about that piece is the two women at the center of it.
I'm not sure you realize this. Like, you just talked for a long time. in a really wonderful way, in a totally captivating way. But for a really long time about how much you love this stuff. And it made me wonder a couple of things. One is, I feel like I've been like dancing around this question with you the whole time, and I think you kind of just answered it, which is your job is really fun. It also seems really hard at this current moment. And the way you just talked about those stories kind of helps explain to me how you are so game for the job, you know? Like it feels pretty like nakedly optimistic to me. Does that sound right to you?
I guess so. Yeah, I think I am pretty optimistic. Yeah.
Yeah, you just seem so hyped. And then which is another question. I think GQ is such a strong brand, right? Like you guys are celebrating your 60th anniversary. This thing's been around for a long time. It has so much to do with fashion.
Yeah.
Did it ever drive you crazy that's what GQ is, and GQ is maybe not as well known for these things that you just beautifully monologued about?
Yes, it does frustrate me sometimes. When we call like a senator's office, the first thing they say is, so you're going to put me in a suit?
Yeah.
And I get so tired of that question. By the same token, I recognize that that is the secret to it all, that I can get away with murder because people think one thing. And remember what I said earlier about constancy and surprise? They're constantly surprised that GQ does this stuff. And I could sit there and be frustrated by it, or I could just say, okay, this is an opening, this is an opportunity, and I'll surprise the fuck out of them, and I'll do it again next month.
Are you still surprising the fuck out of yourself?
I mean, I can't imagine not wanting to, or not hoping that I was going to surprise myself or other people, but I'm also like, I'm just thinking that now it's a good time, since that whole business is broken. Just, I think in some ways it's a freeing up time that people can, if the system is a little broken, you have a little bit more leeway to experiment. So that's my next year, and some is just going to be about experimenting.
Make it sound real fun, man. Jim, thank you for doing this.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Our editor this week was Janelle Pfeiffer, and our intern is Angela Velez. Thanks to them. Thanks to our sponsors, MailChimp and Squarespace. And thanks very much to Jim Nelson. I'm going to be a little earnest here for a second. I was actually legitimately, genuinely inspired by that conversation. So thank you, Jim. We will see you next week. If you would like to see us in person, we'll be in Chicago on November 12th. I'll be interviewing Zoe Chace from This American Life. And that's a live show. You can buy tickets. Another live show, November 15th. It's a Wednesday night. Evan will be in San Francisco interviewing Kara Swisher. Should be a great conversation. Links are in the show notes. Come say hello. We'll be hanging out after both of those. Okay, now, really, we'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright.
exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within art, beats, and lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu.
Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.